Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to violence.
Welcome to Lost in the Static.
This is Lost in the Static. Scott is brain dead, so I'll do the Amazon promo right away. Scott's had a really, really, really long 2 days.
Ah, yes.
So go to 1201beyond.com, click on the Amazon links, and then if you're going to be shopping at Amazon anyway, anything you buy will help us out a little bit. Costs you nothing. You don't get anything extra, but it costs you nothing. So go to 1201beyond.com and just click on the Amazon links that are on the webpage. And there's a UK one. There's a US one. So pretty much anywhere you are. Did I leave anything out?
Nope. Okay. Just Canada, and everybody does that. So don't worry.
Okay. So tonight's topic is actually going to be a follow-up on another Sanity article. And I can't say I wrote it because we wrote it.
Yes, it was a fun article. I mean, you sent me a basic outline
I basically wrote my parts first.
Yep.
And then I was thinking of you while writing it because I knew you'd fight with me on almost everything I was going to say. So
and
I'm
I
just
did.
Like, do you want in? Do you want in on this? Do you want to retort me on this?
And I said, hell yes.
I think your first thing was, how much time do I got?
Yeah, basically. But, you know, am I under deadline here?
24 it's like, yeah, hours. But you got about 24 hours before I got to have this in.
Okay, done.
Because, like I said, you were kind of an afterthought.
Thanks.
But it turned out kind of well. And so you see me being mostly negative and Scott being mostly positive, although you did, there was a couple of them where you're like, I can't really fight you on that one too much.
Yeah, a few. Would you like me to, I believe I have the article here somewhere. There it is.
What it is that I can't stand, I think the 90s were a void of creativity. And let me preface all this, Scott, with, I get the whole baby steps thing, that we would not be where we are in some of these fields without the advancements made in the 90s. I get that. But that doesn't mean those advancements were pretty, and it doesn't mean that they're fondly remembered.
And that doesn't mean that it's a void of creativity.
I thought it was a waste of a decade.
No, are you kidding me? It was a great decade, and I adored the 90s. I really did. Just because, I mean, number one, our economic climate was 10 billion times better than it is now.
Gas was under a dollar a gallon.
Gas was 88 cents, I think, where I was. And you look at this, and let's take a look at the Atari 2600 from the early 80s, right?
Technically 79.
Technically 79, but let's be realistic.
I know, but I'm saying, you know, really, it's a 70s product.
You know, versus something in 1999.
Like I said, I'm not discounting the baby steps we had.
No,
to
not
take.
Just baby steps. There were incredible differences. Incredibly huge steps were taken in the 90s. Gigantic, enormous steps were taken in the 90s.
Okay, let's go.
Okay, we'll go point by point here.
Point by point, okay. I think it was, in general, I think the 90s were a complete waste. I don't like most of the stuff that came from the 90s. I don't like most of the pop culture. I can't stand the computer technology that came from the 90s. I can't stand the over-reliance on computers that we got in the 90s. I can't stand the fashions from the 90s. I can't stand most of the movies from the 90s. Can't stand the music from the 90s. I can't stand the cartoons from the 90s. The 90s just, they did not do anything for me where they clearly did for you.
I take the opposite stance on just about everything you said. And I mean, and that's not even an exaggeration. I mean, I look at the 90s, they were my coming into my own decade as well. So there is a little bit of a sentimental nostalgia there.
Okay, yeah.
But
for the audience that doesn't remember, Scott and I are the same age.
Right.
Almost literally. We're like a week and a half apart. And so we both became adults in the 90s.
Right. But let's look at the decade, and I look back at what we did, even from even from, say, when we graduated high school in 1993.
Right.
Clear on through the rest of the decade versus where we were in 99, 2000. You know, it's not only did we grow exponentially in my case, in both emotional maturity and in physical maturity, but
your hairline decreased.
My hairline went back. Yes. I started the decade with a beautiful and beautifully coiffed mullet and finished with what I have now, basically, which is not much.
Well, see, okay. Now, I have a theory, and I'm going to psychoanalyze myself here a little bit, and I have a feeling you'll agree with this theory, though. I have a theory of why I prefer the 80s more than the 90s, okay? You and I both, we only lived through half of the 70s, and it was a half we really don't remember due to our ages.
Right.
And we became adults in the 90s.
Right.
We were children through all of the 80s.
Yes.
And I think that I'm looking at the 80s through a child's eyes, where I'm looking at the 90s through an adult's eyes. So I'm looking at the 90s and being more critical because I was a much more critical person than in 1997 than I was in 1987. Does my psychoanalysis there make sense?
It does, and it's kind of interesting because I have the exact opposite deal. I look at the 80s through the eyes of a child, and I have some great memories of some great trips and great family times and stuff like that. But I was always my father's son or my mother's son or my sister's little brother. I didn't really have an identity of my own. And pretty much what I did was travel, study, and play. And elementary school was probably one of the crappiest times of my life because my elementary school class caused half of the staff of my elementary school to retire.
And see, I'm the opposite. I had an identity. I was that weird kid. I was the outsider. I was the one looking for the strange stuff and that was trying to go against the grain. And then I saw when it came to the 90s, everyone said, against the grain is dangerous. Everyone should be the same. And maybe that's one thing I fight against just as part of my personality. Does that make sense?
See, and I didn't get that effect from the 90s at all. I really didn't. In fact, in college, living with people like my roommate Mike and his girlfriend Chantel and their friend Ryan and the other 20-some hobos we had coming in and out of my dorm room throughout college, against the grain was exactly what you should be.
Except, see, there's an inherent problem right in that. It became its own clique. You know, it was like what happened to punk in the late 80s. Everyone started dressing the same. Everyone started wearing basically a uniform and thinking the same. And you stopped being outside. Ah. You stopped being against the grain. Against the grain became with the grain. Does that make sense?
But it does. But the thing was, I was in college. And it was kind of everybody at college versus the real world. And so it was still a very much against the grain within my little, you know, social ecosystem. It was still very much, you know, we were against the professors. We were against things like that. We had a few really cool liberal professors who were right there at against the world with us. And you didn't have that. You never had that experience because you got married right out of high school, pretty much.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to say that you're either a better or worse person for it, but I think that simply because of the circumstances of your life, you were denied a very, very interesting and socially challenging and really that growth period of college and that freedom of after high school being an adult and being completely free. Now, due to circumstances in your life, you had a son, you had...
I knocked her up while I was still in high school, yes.
You had a son, you had a wife, and so I think that you were pretty much booted out of high school and went, okay, you're a complete adult now, and this is the way it is. You are now husband and father. And
I think that made me who I am.
Yes, it made you who you are. That's why I said it didn't make you...
That's also what made me hard and cynical and hating the 90s because I saw, maybe it's the fact that I had to grow up too fast.
I think that's what I'm saying.
I became so critical of everything. And okay, it's like Hank Carlson calls me the angriest man in the world.
Yes.
I think the 90s are the reason I'm so goddamn angry.
And I think that had you experienced the decade through different eyes, had you had a little bit of that I'm an adult and I am free type of a growth period, I don't think you would be quite so cynical, and I think you would find the absolute joys of the 90s. For instance, throughout the 90s, I got laid more than any other time in my life.
I got laid on a regular basis too. It was just with one person.
Exactly. God.
You're married though, so your wife.
Why did I get married? But but nonetheless, you know, it was, had you been able to experience that, you know, what a lot of people experience in their late teens and early 20s, I don't think you would be quite so hard or angry or cynical toward the 90s as you are today. I think that you're blaming the decade for shaping you into who you are, when really what it was your own choices early in that decade that shaped it.
See, like on an esoteric level, I see what you're saying, but I really am gonna find amusement in you trying to defend some of the pop culture.
Oh, not a problem.
To me.
Not because, a problem.
Because okay, let's move on. First thing
the
on here, other than
one,
our general first overall general.
The first one that you mentioned is music, and we've already discussed that you and I have radically different tastes in music.
Right, but I don't think you can deny that the 90s is what brought in the, it might not be what we call auto-tune today, but the auto-tune and the, it doesn't matter if she can't sing at all, it sounds great once we get it mixed.
No, it didn't. It really didn't. The auto-tune came about maybe late in the 90s, early in the 2000s, and it was especially a hip-hop artist named T-Pain that made it really bad, because he wouldn't even attempt to sing. He'd just talk into auto-tune, and it sounded awful. Auto-tune came about in the early 2000s, so I think...
Well, like I said, it's not quite auto-tune, but it's like the boy band thing. You know, if you ever listen to any of the raw recordings of, like, NSYNC, and then the album version, they're two radically different things.
Oh, they're tweaked.
So much has been done in a computer.
They are tweaked
to
hell.
That the computer made that final version to me, not the singers.
And that is one thing that we did see in the 90s, and I'm not going to fight you on that, especially in the boy bands. You know, but they had to, I mean, the boy bands were a manufactured product.
And that goes back to the 80s too, so that's why I'm not blaming that.
Right, but they got, you know, they got huge in the 90s, but they were a manufactured product. And they came about with a target audience in mind. And so do I consider boy bands music? Well, yes, on one level, because you had to have some talent to be in one. But on another level, you're right. But I see them as a manufactured product rather than what I see as the true, and we've always had that manufactured pop sound. So I just see that as a constant in music.
Well, but then,
but there were two sounds. There were two distinct sounds that came out in the 90s. That
did my mic
really
pick up
changed.
My neck just cracking?
Yes,
there?
It did. There were two distinct sounds that really encompassed the 90s to me. And again, you and I have radically different views on these. The first is the first one that hit me. Pretty much while I was still in high school. And it's funny you talk about computers making music, because 91, 92, 93...
Are you talking techno?
Not just techno, but you've got chiptunes, you've got the demo scene, which you're like, it's all techno to me, but it's not.
Yeah, I mean, I know how racist it sounds. It's
okay,
all the same to me.
Chiptunes are the bleepy bloopy stuff that you can hear on a C64. But people were taking chiptunes and adding, instead of four voices or eight voices, adding 64 voices or 128 voices later in the decade. And if you can imagine a Commodore 64 symphony, and yes, it's very niche, but it's still impressive on a technical level. When you talk about the demo scene, you talk about artists building using MIDI most of the time. So there is still an instrument there being piped into a computer and creating anything from a techno sound to a rock sound to jazz to symphonic music completely within the computer. And a lot of this, and I'll have to find some and play it for you someday, is actually very impressive and sounds a lot like an analog instrument. And so you, but this media manipulation, this musical manipulation of the demo scene and of 90s techno and stuff like that was stuff that we had never, you know, computers weren't powerful enough to create what a lot of people call real music.
Except, see, to me, the computer should not be a component of the music. I know I'm getting all into the purity of rock and stuff, but when, for instance, I this might be 2000s or might be 90s, when Metallica did one of their albums, they recorded all their stuff so separately. Some of them were in different states. And here's the guitar track, okay? Here's the bass track. And it's later, and the computer lays it all together. To me, that's not playing as a band. That's not recording an album as a band. Recording an album as a band is you all being in the studio together and recording an album as a band. Not recording an album with each track or each different guitar track a month apart and then putting it all together, editing it in a computer. That's not putting together a music album to me.
And I hate to tell you this, but they had been doing music albums like that with four-track tape and with, you know, two-inch reel-to-reel.
And I've always had 70s. A problem with that, but it got worse when the computer just made it that much easier. I've always had issues with that.
I understand. So your problem is what you would consider separation.
And does it end up
sounding too sterile for you?
Partially, and it also doesn't sound collaborative, because when you're in a studio, you got the guitar player and the bass player standing next to each other. The bass player can make a tiny little change, and the guitar player can pick up on that and change with it or fight against it, which creates a unique sound. When they're recording their tracks months apart on opposite sides of the country, you don't get that collaborative effect. To me, the music is lost when the computer is the combining component rather than the band being the combining component.
Or in the case of many in the 70s and 80s, the audio engineer.
Yeah. And but there's even a difference there. He's doing it live. You know, they're all in the studio together, and he's playing with the knobs right then and there. He's not in the computer months later going, well, let's move this, and we'll manipulate this, and we'll rise this.
See, and I don't,
it's kind of being done. The manipulation is sort of live.
I don't see any difference.
I do. It's more tactile. It's more real. You know, I'm a much more tactile person.
I know.
So, I mean, music, I think the music of the 90s, the bad shit in the 70s, the bad shit in the 80s is still listenable. The bad shit in the 90s, I don't think, I mean, it's the stuff that makes cats' heads explode.
See, and I'm just the opposite. Because after I got into the demo scene and the chiptune stuff and whatnot, I moved my way. It's kind of a logical leap into techno dance and the European dance stuff.
The only techno song I like is Mortal Kombat.
Which is actually really funny because I hate to say it, but the Mortal Kombat theme really sounds generic. And if you look at Eurodance at the time, almost all of the music, you know, they went,
I know, it sounds just like everything else that was out at the time.
Exactly.
I get that.
I can touch three keys and get an orchestra hit. Set it to a drum beat, we've got a tune. And I look back and I'm like, why was I listening to that? But at the same time, you know, I get it. But I hear this stuff, and to me, the computer is a tool.
Well, we're going to talk more about computers.
I know, we'll get there. But when it comes to musicality, whether it's tracks coming together from being recorded months or in some cases years apart and separated by geography as well as anything else, to see that stuff coming together and to form a cohesive bit of music is more impressive to me. It's incredible. And to have an audio engineer's ear like that, to be able to mesh them together, is incredible. And that lead, you know, that's what led into everything from hard style dubstep today to, you know, to the mashup universe, to all kinds of other. And I saw this coming together in the 90s, and I saw people going, wait, this computer is something that we can use to create what I believe is absolutely beautiful music. Even simply being able to multitrack more than four things at once was unbelievable.
And to me, that also leads to a very overproduced sound. Look at, like, Meatloaf's I'd Do Anything for Love, But I Won't Do That. That is probably one of the most overproduced, overblown songs of all time.
But that overproduction,
because they had the ability to do it, so they said, why not?
Yeah, but that overproduction was a choice of the artist and the engineer. A bad choice, frankly, in that song's case, because I am not a fan of that particular Meatloaf song.
You want to know something that's just weirdly ironic?
You want to know another one that
well,
I'm
no,
oh, sure,
before
go
we
ahead.
Go off Meatloaf, you know who directed the music video?
Who?
Michael Bay. Michael Bay directed the music video for I'd Do Anything for
Did
Love.
Anything blow up in that video?
The opening shot is a helicopter on a sunset. Right there. That's Michael Bay.
Yeah,
but yes, Michael, he also directed Divinyl's I Touch Myself.
Did any vaginas blow up in that one?
But so yeah, but Michael Bay directed that Meatloaf video, people.
Was she masturbating in a helicopter over a sunset or
while the camera's spinning around and around?
Exactly.
Now, he hadn't come into his own yet. This was still the early 90s.
Okay. But you know, when it comes to I see this computer being used as a tool more and more, and being able to do and make these sounds that absolutely no analog instrument would ever be able to make. And I think it's incredible.
And you and I are never going to agree on this.
Yeah, I see it as a new horizon, as something that, you know,
I see it as a step backwards.
You're still going to need that musician's ear. I make my music on my computer. Could you do me a favor and point out the big button that says make music? Because that, what really irritates me when you say this is that you go, it's just talentless hacks banging away on keyboards. Where is my make music button?
You don't have advanced enough keyboard for that. Let's move on to the next thing.
Yeah, and
spent a lot of time on this, and I don't want to miss out on the other stuff.
All right,
so
fine.
I'm not trying to dodge. I'm trying to say we got a lot of stuff to fit
in
here.
Fine. Okay. I didn't even get to touch on grunge and the resurgence of punk and
analog
music.
No. Okay.
So.
We will take a minute for this. No, grunge is not the resurgence of
yes,
punk.
Yes, it is.
No,
yeah,
it's
it is.
Not.
Yeah, it is. It's punk.
No, it's, not.
It's punk with real musicality.
No fucking way.
As opposed to idiots banging.
Grunge is fucking noise. It's noise, and every fucking grunge band sounds exactly the same to me.
Oh,
you cannot tell me.
And you're going to defend this with the punk, with things like Misfits and
Dead Kennedys?
Sound
totally different.
No, they
the
don't.
The Sex Pistols and Fugazi sound totally different.
No, they
yes.
all sound as if they can't play the instruments that they've got in their hands.
You are so ignorant. All right, what was next?
Movies.
I couldn't remember if I did movies or TV next.
You did movies next.
All right, try to defend 90s movies in general. Obviously, there's some good 90s movies, but try to defend 90s movies in general to me that they were not a creative void. And let's leave CGI out because that's a whole different topic down the line.
Okay, well, in general, yeah, you had just like any other decade. Okay. Any other decade starting with the 80s. You had the big popcorn summer blockbuster flicks that everybody was going for.
Technically the 70s. Jaws was the beginning of that. 75.
Okay. All right. You're right. Jaws was. Okay. So from any other decade other than, you know, prior to
from
the
our
70s.
Birth year. Ironically enough, our entire lifetime.
But you had the studios going for the big popcorn flicks, and they were out there. They've always been out there. At the same time, you have always had indie filmmakers and avant-garde filmmakers and other filmmakers that rise to the top and become the movies that we remember. When it comes to the 90s, I've forgotten the crap. I really have.
And see, I live in it.
And that's your own choice.
Because
a stupid choice, but
to me, movies got much more, and I don't mean this in a literal sense, but much more monotone. They became much more, we don't want to do anything different. We just do the same thing over and over and over again, which partially is due to sequelitis.
And they did that in the 80s, too.
Not as much. Okay, you look at movies from decade to decade to decade, and the 70s and 80s might fight for this honor, but the 70s and 80s, you had ideas that would never have been made into a $20 million film in the 90s or in the 2000s. You would have never had a studio backing a movie like Videodrome in 1992 instead of 1982. You would have never had studio backing for something like Easy Rider in 1996. Never.
Sure you would.
No, you would not.
Yeah, you would.
You would have never had studio backing for anything like that. Yes,
you
would have.
You honestly would have. It's just that the studios backed things like Seven.
Oh, actually, Seven was technically New Line was still an indie studio then.
Well,
so no, the studio didn't. I mean, a studio did a big budget, like Universal Paramount. No, because New Line was still putting out relatively small flicks that would only open to 200 theaters in the country. New Line was still a relatively small company back then.
Okay, then explain to me Oliver Stone in the 90s.
Oliver Stone worked for Universal and Paramount and Warner Brothers and shit like that.
Right.
He was a studio guy.
And he did things like character studies. He did things like Natural Born Killers. He did things like JFK. He did things
Think Natural Born Killers was sort of an anomaly. And that's a good thing, because I love the movie. But that's one of those ones where I'm surprised a studio released NBK. I really am.
But they did.
Yeah.
And how many copycats did it launch?
Quite a few.
Doom Generation, which was crap.
Which I still haven't seen.
Oh.
Brad's called it the worst film he's ever sat through in his entire life.
I will second that one.
Hates that movie with such a passion.
Yeah, I can see why. It's everything good about Natural Born Killers
is not there.
Well, okay. Everything that a 12-year-old would think was good about Natural Born Killers is then blown up 10 times, and everything that would make an insecure person go tee-hee, 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 yeah, is then 10 times larger, and it's off. You look at it and you're like, oh God, that is 90s shooting. But you had movies in the 90s that came out that were just incredible movements. I mean, yes, there were always the big studios, just like there always will be the big studios backing the popcorn stuffing, generally duh movies, Battleship, but at the same time, you did have other filmmakers that took a chance. I really think Oliver Stone paved the way for people like Rodriguez, for people like even Tim Burton.
No way, Tim Burton. In the 90s, that's when he decided, I ain't making movies no more. I'm just going to make the same movie over and over and over again. That's where he started his shit with that. I'm just going to make the same movie every 2 years.
Okay.
Just with a different cast, and we'll give it a different title.
Now he's making different movies with the same cast?
Yeah.
I'm confused. Anyway, no, I really think that there was a tonal switch in the 90s from the 80s. I mean, the 80s, when you look at things like Wall Street, when you look at things like the Vietnam War flicks that were coming out, they were excellent.
Platoon, Full Metal Jacket.
Platoon, Full Metal Jacket. They were excellent. But they were...
Word fell out of your head.
Yeah, they were life as presented as anyone could experience.
And see,
the 90s, I think movies took a tonal switch and said, let's take a look at the abstract side of life.
And see, I think the 90s are where people like a Michael Bay was able to flourish and go, people like seeing shit blowed up real good, and they like seeing one-liners. They like the guy going, the Iceman cometh. That's what they want. That's what audiences wanted in the 90s. They wanted a one-liner after somebody gets killed, and they wanted a whole bunch of shit to blow up.
Oh, I'm not denying that that audience was out there, is still out there, and has been out there since the exploitation days. Speaking of wanting to hear one-liners and maybe some boobs and some blood and some shit blow it up real good in a good car chase, that's the whole point to exploitation. You can't look at me and say, you know, that Fraulein's in Uniform is a character study of the Nazi party in the Ford. No. No, it wasn't. It was some boobs.
So are you trying to say Double Team was a character study?
Okay, no, I'm not. Bad Boys was. But it's...
Let's go on to TV. Wait, there is something more else I got to talk about in movies.
What I'm saying with movies is the crap that you talk about was always there, will always be there. It's a constant.
But the 90s also spawned what I think is the worst and biggest step backwards in the history of film.
Okay.
The post-Scream horror film. That is the biggest step back in film since the inception of film.
How so?
Everyone said, oh my God, the way we did is wrong. People want self-aware. They want teens. They want 20-somethings playing teens. And they don't want anything that's not basically a comedy with people getting stabbed. More bad movies came out after Scream than I think in the history of film prior to Scream.
I don't know.
And I blame Scream and that piece of shit film for the absolute degradation of the horror film.
So what you're talking about is that for the past 70 years, they've been making horror films. Somebody changes it. It ends up being a success.
A terrible, idiotic success.
In your mind.
You're trying to tell me that those Scream knockoff movies were good movies?
No. But they were different, and they held my
attention.
No, they
weren't. They were all exactly the same.
And Scream held my... They were different from the 70 years prior of... Okay, he's the killer. Okay, look, it's the monster again. Oh, how are they going to bring him back this time? Woo.
I disagree. I think Scream is a blight on everything that is filmed.
Somebody put a mirror up against slasher flicks, realized how stupid they were, came up with something just as stupid.
First, he did not do that. Kevin Williamson and Wes Craven did not do that. That had been done years prior with movies like Slaughter High and movies like that held a mirror up to even the early 80s version of the slashers and made fun of them. Movies like The Howling was making fun of the old Universal films. All they did is go, now the audience knows all the jokes.
Exactly. Somebody finally acknowledged the intelligence of the audience.
That's what all the early 80s parodies did.
No, they didn't.
Go on to TV. We're not going to come to agreement on this.
Right.
I think TV...
Would you put my geek pen back on my pen? Thank you.
I think TV was worse in the 90s than even in the 2000s. I think with a few exceptions, you know, I mean, yeah, you had your X-Files pop in and you had your Twin Peaks and whatnot, which, you know, Twin Peaks failed, but that's not the point. You name me an actual good 90s sitcom.
Fresh Prince of Bel-Air.
I said good as in funny or quality.
I stand behind my choice.
I think your brain has leaked out your ears. That show was anything but quality. And I think TV was just a cultural void. It got dumber as the audiences got dumber. It got actually more mainstreamed than 80s TV did. It got more predictable than 80s TV did. And I just, TV was a wasteland.
Okay. First off, I'm going to stand with you and I'm going to stand against you. Prime time, yeah, I'll stand with you. Crap like Full House. And
what did that last? 8-9 years? Yeah. Something like that? It's ridiculous.
And Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. Yes. Crap. I happen to enjoy Friends, but I think that's more the memories that are attached to watching it than the actual sitcom itself. But I think primetime, you're right. We started to see the fall into what I would call Larry the Cable Guy vision.
Yeah, it became dumber, and it became, like, in the 70s and 80s, you could have a show that only hit a certain audience. By the 90s, it had to hit everybody, so everything was vanillatized.
But the reason, and again, primetime, I'm not fighting with you. I think the reason for that is because of the proliferation of cable, because of the proliferation of the internet, and because people started finding the esoteric stuff on their own, and still are today. I'm not going to fight you when it comes to primetime, but there is one that I will fight you with, and that is that when it comes to the 90s, I think kids' animation started to stand on its own two feet and started to talk not only to kids, but to the kids that grew up with it and the adults at the time, i.e. you and me.
Other than Animaniacs and Tiny Toons, I'd fight with you on that.
Animaniacs, Tiny Toons, all of the Steven Spielberg ones.
Because I always couldn't stand shit like Freakazoid and...
That's Steven Spielberg. Yeah. I will stand behind that one.
There was the great failure, and I don't mean failure in a creative sense, failure in a rating sense, of like Attack of the Killer Tomatoes, the TV series. Something that tried to be both kid-friendly and adult-friendly in a way that it didn't work with audiences. Except it's funny to watch them now, because now you go, man, there was something here. Back in 1990, everyone went, this is dumb.
Yeah. And I'm sorry. I was with them. I stand with them. I think
the show is absolutely hilarious. It's
a bad idea for a series from the go.
I absolutely loved it. I loved Attack of the Killer Tomatoes, the series.
But what I like is, and the reason why I'm kind of centering around the Spielberg properties, including Freakazoid, and you also had shows like Sam and Max pop up for a brief time.
Yeah, that was what, eight episodes,
but excellent writing. Steve Purcell was involved. Purcell, I can never remember his first name. He was involved, and it showed, and it spoke to both kids and adults. It was also a time. Let's look at animation from the 80s and especially the proliferation of Hanna-Barbera 8-frame cartoons.
They really had their heyday in the 70s.
They had their heyday in the 70s, but it lasted into the 80s because, yes, you had your cell counts increased, you had your art style changed to a more 80s art style, but with very, very few exceptions, they still had that moral message hammer that they felt the need to just slam kids with at all times. It wasn't until the 90s and the Spielberg revolution where animators themselves went, for fuck's sake, let's put this down and just start entertaining people.
Well, and then we'll save this for CGI, even though we're running low on time. You also had the integration...
We might have to stretch this into two episodes.
You had the integration of CGI into the cartoons, and you had the computer-generated cartoons, which... They were ugly then. They're ugly now.
No.
I cannot...
They were different and exciting and something
no,
new.
No, they were ugly when it happened. Like Transformers Generation 2. When that first aired in 94, I think, maybe 95, I went, this is horrendous looking. You look back at it now and you go, my God, my watch can make better CGI graphics than this now.
Of course it does.
Hell?
Your watch is from 2012.
You know what I mean.
No, I don't.
The graphics were horrendous.
By today's
standards,
they were
bad then.
Yes.
I hated the crap then. It looked like garbage then. It looks worse now to me.
To you. To me, I looked at CGI stuff and I thought that's amazing. And you look at a series like Reboot,
which I hated.
Which of course you do. I enjoyed because number one, it was the first geek. It was the one that popped up and went, okay, we're going to talk to geeks. They might have something, so we'll speak their language. But you look back at it now and you're like, oh, that is a little rough. But then you look at Transformers Beast Wars,
which is
But it's a step. You know, you go from Reboot to that given really badly CG animated Starship Troopers.
Roughnecks.
Roughnecks. And that series, which you look at today and you're like, yeah, but you can see where they're going. And then you see Transformers Beast Wars and you go, yeah, it's still pretty CG and it's still somewhat, you know, it's still there, but it's a step in the right direction. And then you look at CG today.
But not really. Look at like Transformers Prime on the hub. That looks as bad as Beast Wars did in the 90s. No,
it doesn't. It looks 2,000 times better.
Oh, I cannot disagree with you more. That actually looks, to me, it looks like wireframes that they just said, screw it, we don't have time, just color them in.
Just skin them.
And it's like that, the Transformers Prime is everything that is wrong with a CG cartoon.
We can disagree. But, you know, I look at these and I look back at where they were and I look at how I looked at them at the time. I thought it was incredible. You know, this is this
and I was
is,
cynical and mean.
This is stuff that you couldn't do with anything less than a Silicon Graphics machine. And suddenly they were making Saturday morning cartoons with them. Or weekday morning cartoons or whatever the hell. They were making cartoons with them.
I was gonna say that's another thing, and we've talked about it before, the death of Saturday morning.
Yeah, well, the death of Saturday morning is again
unfortunate.
It's unfortunate, but I can see where it came from. It came from splinterification.
Yeah, I was gonna say the splintering off in the cable, but
exactly. But okay, so we disagree there because I look at them how I looked at them then and they were absolutely incredible. You look at them now, yeah, they're a little rough. But you look at them then and you're like, my God, they're able to do this. You know, take somebody from back then, show them Toy Story, and their jaw will hit the floor and they'll piss themselves.
And you take somebody from now and you show them Beast Wars and their jaw will hit the floor and they'll piss themselves laughing. It goes both ways.
Only if they're too young and stupid to not realize that this was a step to where they were. You can't drive to California and look back on Colorado and go, you're a bunch of idiots.
I would.
It's a necessary drive through. But anyway.
All right. So what do we have next after TV? Because I just, bleh.
You know, again, primetime, I can't fight with you much on that one because we did have the emergence of things like Full House and stuff like that. But
well,
animation,
then,
yeah.
Then we had CGI.
Yep.
Now, even the CGI obviously goes back to even the 80s. I mean, Westworld had CG in it. The when the robots are looking and you see all the like whatnot, that from their point of view, that was a computer generated image.
It's a computer generated image with being touched up by hand and stuff like that.
And one famous thing, because I have a feeling, let's say fuck it, we'll break this into a two-parter.
Yeah.
One famous early, and I'm making quotes, early CG image isn't. The wireframe readout on Snake's glider in Escape from New York.
No, that was hand animated.
Yeah, no, it wasn't even animation. It wasn't even animation. That was a special effect made by James Cameron. What they did is they built the entire city, painted it all black, and then put lights around the shapes of all the buildings and just backlit it. It was literally a practical effect. And I can't tell you how many websites I've seen that says that was the first true CG image.
No.
And James Cameron goes, nah, here's the set. We built that. We just shot it through the camera. There's no computer generation whatsoever in what you're seeing on his computer. And that to me is true brilliance. They said, we can't do this, but we need to. How do we do it? Nowadays, you've lost that. Nowadays, people go, there's the image. You don't have someone like Cameron going, how do I make it look like that without even needing the computer?
No. Today, the computer is just a more powerful tool. Okay? People don't walk up and go, the image. No. You're completely discrediting artistry. Whether you think it's good artistry or bad artistry, it is artistry. It takes the eye and the soul of an artist to create even scientific visualizations of data. You still have to have a little bit of scientists still use artists to come in and go, okay, here's our data.
Why would scientists be visualizing Brent Spiner? You said visualizations of data. Star Trek joke. I'm trying to be funny. Never mind. He's just staring at me.
So anyway, you still have scientists bringing in artists to create this CG visualization of various data that they've collected. But, you know, in movies, it takes the eye of an artist to create this stuff. Well, you know,
but it takes the mind of a true artist to go, I can't do any of this in a computer. How do I do this with a practical? How do I do this with some stuff from the hardware store?
First off, fuck you for calling anybody that works with a computer not a true artist. Okay, fuck you hard for that. Because the truth is, I know plenty of true artists that work beautifully with computers.
I don't consider the computer an art tool.
And that is your problem. That's because you're a Luddite and an idiot who goes, I see this tool of the future and how everything is going to be done. Fuck it.
Fuck it, yes, because it took over the industry.
Do you know why it took over?
You don't have practical effects people anymore.
That's right.
And that's not a good thing.
No, it's not. It's not a bad thing either. Because you have to have the stuff up there that is crappy in order for somebody to come along and go, I can make that better.
But you've got this huge problem in Hollywood right now that CG has created this like blast wave of knocking out all the real people. When a movie wants to go back and like one of those throwback movies, and they say we want to do this all practical, they go, shit, nobody currently employed by the studio has any idea how to do a fucking practical anymore. All they do is sit behind a keyboard all day. Shit, we've got to get all the people out of retirement to do the fucking practical models now. That's a fucking problem.
No, it's not.
When all the employees, all the effects people are computer people. That's a problem.
Josh, you knock out all of the old busted people that given were wonderful artists in their day and did some amazing things practically.
That's absolutely ridiculous.
Now it is impractical to be practical.
And that is absolutely ridiculous.
No, it's not.
Yes, it is. It brings up the whole Kevin Smith thing from Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back again. And the laziness of modern filmmaking. The sheep fucker scene. Remember where they throw Sean William Scott out of the thing for admitting he'd fuck a sheep? Well, that scene originally went on longer, where after they drive away, he sees a sheep in a field and goes, hey, baby, how you doing? And he walks off frame to it. Well, it would have cost $10,000 to get the sheep there, to get the sheep handler, to get, you know, everything. Or Kevin Smith said, hey, it'll cost $25,000 just CG the sheep, and it's faster and it's easier, so we'll just do that. That's laziness. That's lazy filmmaking. Doesn't matter if it costs more. It's faster. It's easier. Just do it. That's lazy filmmaking. I will not countenance lazy filmmaking.
In which case, do me a favor and point your anger toward the lazy filmmakers and not the artists that are improving CG
and trying to make it better.
You're blaming the technology for idiocy. Do not do that.
The technology, to me, a CG should be to improve the practical. Like in Blade Runner, you go out and take out the wires. You know, you take out maybe the cameraman's reflection from the window or something like that. You use it to enhance the practical.
So
you remove
hoping
the matte lines. The computer should not make the spaceship fly.
So what you're saying right now is that you're hoping that all progress stagnates.
When it comes to CGI, I hope CGI dies a fucking hard death. I hate CGI so much. I want CGI to completely collapse in upon itself.
Enjoy your 1970s, you idiot.
CGI should not be here. And there's no way we're going to fit all this in. So this is definitely a two-parter because we got 5-6 minutes left. So let's stick with CGI. I don't want to start another one of these since we're going to have to finish rushing quick. CGI, to me, is the bane of good filmmaking.
And what I think that you're... No, I'll tell you what the bane of good filmmaking is. It's bad filmmakers making bad decisions.
It's kind of like if the CG was not so easy and so relatively cheap.
Can you do
they
it?
They would not be tempted by that. And they'd go, you know what? I need a dragon to come out of the water and eat this boat. Well, how do we do that? Well, you can have a miniature and you do this. Well, that sounds complicated. Can't we just pay that dude on the computer to do it? Okay.
If it's so easy, why not do it yourself?
What do you mean, the CG or the practical?
You. Sit down
because
at a computer.
Because I don't want to.
No.
I hate CG. Why would I want to do CGI?
Because I want you to prove to me. Because I want you to prove to me what you're saying is creating art is easy. It's pushing a fucking button and doing it that way. When you're missing so much of the artistry to it. Yes, some of it looks rough. And if you look back at the 90s, the CG looks really, really rough by today's standards. It even looked rough and imposing back then. When you can look at something and go, that's CG. But, you know, practicals, there was a time when you could look and you go, that's a fake.
Yeah, there's
they got better. So does CG.
And okay, I'm
and for you to be discounting artists like this, just wholeheartedly going, everything you do sucks, is so insulting to people.
I think it should be insulting to the people who are that lazy. I mean, I was reading an interview, and I can't remember if it was Wired or something like that, maybe last year, whereas it was a CG artist talking about all the little things like making, you know, someone's hairs move on their arm or, you know, shit like that. And it was like some Nicolas Cage movie where they had to, like, really CG the shit out of his hair. Might have been Ghost Rider. And he was talking about how, you know, that's his job and how he's a true artist for making Nicolas Cage look better. And he outright said that he would not be able to do that as a practical. And I am better because I can do things on my computer a practical effect could never do. There's that inherent arrogance. I'm better because I sit behind a keyboard. I'm not on set. I'm not getting covered in fake blood. I'm not laying in raccoon piss to try and get the thing. I am better. Because I sit behind a computer and you're actually on set and really can fucking work.
That guy was a dick. And he was a douche. And he was a short-sighted idiot. He does not speak for all CG artists. Because I think CG is not better. Should not be better. It should not be noticed. It should blend perfectly. With practicals. And by the way, I've shit on practical people. No, I don't mean to. Practical artistry is astounding to me.
There's also the...
Not only practical, but Foley, which is basically audio practical. Yes. But, you know, so please don't take it as me shitting on them or anything like that. But do not confuse one man's arrogance and one man's claim of being better, which is just complete douchebaggery for... Everyone speaking that way.
Except I think more of the CG artists think like that than don't.
And you're wrong.
If you look at like, it was on one of the Star Wars DVDs like or something like that, like on episode one, they were going through like ILM. And they were talking about how they don't even have a practical effects department anymore. And he goes, this little machine, and he's talking about it with pride. This little machine right here can do everything those four wings used to do. And he said, I can do what used to take 200 people to do. And there was this arrogance that I am better than those 200 people that worked their ass off.
Josh, you're getting angry at other people for being arrogant.
I'm saying I think more people...
You, Mr. Arrogance himself...
Really?
Yes. ...is getting angry at other people for being arrogant and thereby being arrogant in your own standing. I think that your entire argument is invalid because we've discovered a root of something.
I don't think my argument's invalid.
I think it's completely invalid because you're no longer talking about the art form. You're talking
about the art form. It looks like shit. A practical will always look better.
No.
A practical will always have, in your brain, you see the actor picking up something and you go, that's really there. That's not against a blue screen and then added 9 months later.
No, I think you're wrong.
A true film fan can their brain operates like
that. I'm sorry, I've seen the cheap-ass films of the 70s and 80s and no, practicals looked like crap every now and then. And every once in a while we get somebody that's brilliant. We've got 30 seconds. Let's continue this next week.
Totally. Yeah, because
let's let this one lie.
I really meant this to be a single episode.
I know,
we just
but
kept
it's
going.
Not going to happen. let's let this one lie. Thanks a lot for joining us this week. We are going to continue this next week.
Absolutely.
And
I will continue winning my arguments.
In fact, we will
arguments.
Be continuing this now, and
he
will continue being
winning my arguments.
A complete arrogant douchebag. Go to Amazon. Actually, better yet, go to 1201beyond.com and click on our Amazon link. We could use the help. Thank you so much for joining this week. Josh, you are a fucking douchebag.
Dumbass.